This is Mae Warren. Today is February 9th, 1997. I'm in Dallas, Texas with Doug Hunt, otherwise known as Sparky.
Ooh.
Come on, let's just go for it. Get it over with and then you won't have to worry about it.
Okay. What do you want me to start with?
Tell me about why you know as Sparky.
Oh, okay. Where that came from was my sophomore year. The pledges at the Pi Kappa Alpha fraternity did a raid one night, and it happened to be the same night where I had been booking for a midterm, and I probably didn't do this but two or three times my entire collegiate career. I was so exhausted I'd fallen asleep at 2 or 3 in the morning on my bed, studying, still in all my clothes, and about 3:30 or 4 in the morning, the pledges hit with this raid, and I don't know what they set off. I was on the third floor in an outer bedroom of the fraternity house, and I don't know what they set off in the hallway, but it sounded like an absolute train wreck. I remember coming to thinking there's a train wreck out in the hallway. And I wear contact lenses and, of course, did not have them in at that time. So I came staggering out into the hallway looking around trying to see what was going on, and all I could see was little bits of fire on the rug down the hall, and I was might a bit tired. So, you know, my first thought is, oh, there's little bits of fire in the hallway, we need to put that out. And so I thought, well, I'm not going to do this all by myself. As I walked toward the bathroom, which was in the middle of the hallway, I called fire so I'd get some other guys out there helping. Well, I walked into the bathroom about the point in time I realized I hadn't even woken up enough to pick up a trash can, so I had nothing to put any water in anyway. But then started thinking, wait a minute, that fire didn't seem to be spreading. Could this be a raid? I stepped back out of the bathroom, and I look, and there goes one of my roommates from the other end of the hall down out of the, going right out the fire exit. From the third floor, running down the fire exit. And I'm going, oh boy. I walk over to one of the little pieces of one little spots of fire that I notice isn't spreading. I bent down and looked at it, and sure enough, it was a smoke bomb. My eyes were so bad I hadn't been able to tell. So now I knew what was going on, and apparently I didn't see it, but one of the other guys, while I was in the bathroom, came, apparently had come to and heard the word fire. He had come running out, grabbed his stereo, unplugged it, and come running out, was carrying his stereo down the front stairway before he realized what had happened. Anyway, I then realized what was going on, and I came back toward the hallway, and about this time, the fraternity brother, who was pretty the excitable type anyway, who had gone racing down the fire escape, comes walking back in, takes a look around, and just starts jumping all over me, you stupid idiot. Anyway, the unfortunate part about all this is, unfortunately, the pledges, as they had finished setting everything in the raid and taking off, had heard the word fire when I'd yelled it. And so they got a kick out of that, and somehow somebody remembered an old cartoon about Sparky the Fire Dog. So that, unfortunately, became my nickname for quite a while after that. We were always big on nicknames. In fact, I remember we had one fraternity brother who was a year older than I was, and he had picked up the nickname Doorstop. And from what I understand, where that nickname came from is his freshman year, he had been fairly active in partying, and down on the second floor of the Pi Kappa Alpha house, we had in each quarter of the hallway, 3-bedroom suites. And there would be 2 outer bedrooms, one at the very end of the hallway and one next to the bathroom in the interior end of the hallway. The third bedroom was in between them, but had no door to the hallway. So to get to the third bedroom, you would have to go through one bedroom or the other. And apparently there was a party one time during the week in one of the interior bedrooms. And it appears that this fraternity brother had been holding a door open and everybody else had gone through it, and apparently he picked that exact moment to pass out at the doorway of one of the outer bedrooms leading into the hallway. So the party continues on for a while, and somebody happens to come out to go to the restroom or whatever, and starts to walk out and looks down and sees that his body is blocking the door. And he says, "Hey, come here, everybody. Come see our new doorstop." So forever after, he was known as Doorstop Jones. And that nickname stuck so thoroughly that I remember my sophomore year, which was a year later, we had a fella come to the fraternity house at lunchtime. It was right after lunchtime, so generally it was before afternoon classes had started. And that particular day, we had at least 15, maybe 20 fellas sitting around the fraternity house before either heading home or going back up the hill. This fella, it was on a Friday afternoon, this fella comes walking in and says, "Hi, I'm looking for Rick Jones." And there's silence, and the guy says, "Oh, you mean Craig Jones?" He said, "No, Rick Jones." He said, "Well, there's not a Rick Jones here." And he said, "Well, I'm pretty sure he's in Pi Kappa Alpha fraternity." And we were looking at him thinking, that guy looks familiar, he's been here before. Guy says, "Well, are you sure he's not in the Sigma Nu fraternity?" He says, "No, I really know he's here. Rick Jones, who could that be?" This went on for about 18, 20 seconds. And finally somebody said, "Wait a minute. Are you talking about, could you be looking for a doorstop?" And he said, "Well, what?" And people were talking, "What's Doorstop's first name?" "Oh, yeah. Doorstop, yeah, he's right upstairs." So nicknames tended to stick pretty well at the time I was there. You ask a question about professors, and which I remember best in a lot of respects. Some of those are still very much active at the university. The professor I probably got closest to while I was at the university was Len Girard. And that's kind of an interesting story. I'd always wanted to take a psychology class, but for one reason or another, either I hadn't been able to work it into a schedule, or eventually somebody told me Girard's the best teacher in the department, you ought to wait until you get him for Psych 101. Well, he only taught one introductory psychology section. So when I didn't get him once or twice, I figured, well, I'm in no hurry to take this course. I'm not planning to be a psych major, so I'll just drop that course and I'll try again next semester. And if I don't get it, then I'll quit worrying about it. I ended up as a Psych 101 student my senior year. Now, Psychology 101, that's introductory psychology. Dr. Girard taught one section, as I say. And his course was fascinating, and I came in afterwards, asked some questions of him, and I found it amazing that the head of the department, who was also, some other guys had told me, very much a well-known research professor in his profession, would take the time to literally help a senior who obviously wasn't going to be a major, and obviously was not a long-term player in psychology. And I think that says a lot about the university. Another professor who certainly sticks with me and is still, although he's retired, still very much around Washington Lee is Dr. Johnny Gunn. And I took Dr. Gunn for International Economics, and it was one of the most fascinating courses I can imagine. One of the fun things about it is you never could be absolutely certain what we were going to spend time on when you came in class, because we might be going over some arcane facet of international economics, and a question would come up on, I think one time it was metallurgy, another time it was nuclear fission. And Dr. Gunn knew what was going on. He'd say, "Well, let's take a while and talk about that." And we get off on a subject that had more to do with international economics than you would guess, but certainly wasn't anything to do with the curriculum. And we might spend an hour on that subject. In fact, I look back on it, I think most of the students in there clearly enjoyed the course, because as an afternoon course, it was an hour and a half course. And regularly, it was not unusual at all that we might not finish up until more than 2 hours after the class started. That was the only course I had where that was actually part of the class. And it wasn't anything that Dr. Gunn ever said. I don't think there ever would have been a problem if somebody had to leave the class after an hour and a half. I think we were all interested enough that we chose to stay. And that happened, as I say, more than once, probably a dozen classes during the year. At least, and again became I consider Dr. Gunn a good friend. Another professor who I really enjoyed was Dr. Colvin. Had two courses under Dr. Colvin. In fact, I told him a story that I think may have halfway horrified him, quite honestly, because I don't think he found it nearly as funny in retrospect as I did. But one of the big facets of Washington and Lee that is very beneficial is independent exams, both to the student and I think to the student's sense of responsibility. And as you may be aware, with independent exams, you have some flexibility to change your exam schedule if for some reason you decide that's appropriate. I had one semester where I had chosen to take two courses from Dr. Colvin that semester. One was American Foreign Policy, and the other one was International Relations. And I forget the reasons why, but I had originally set my course schedule one way, and I changed it. I had originally been planning to take my American Foreign Policy exam first, and I decided that I changed my course schedule. Excuse me, I think I was originally going to take my International Relations exam first, and I changed my course schedule to American Foreign Policy. But after I made that change, I lost that sheet. So when I started doing my studying, I was working off of the old sheet. And I'm studying very hard for my American Foreign Policy, or for my International Relations exam. I get in there for independent exams and look and pick up my book, and to my horror, it's International Relations. I'm thinking, what happened? And then all of a sudden it hit me. I changed my exam schedule. I have just spent several hours studying for the wrong exam. Well, Dr. Collins pretty much an understanding type, so I immediately went up looking for him to his office. He wasn't in his office. Oh my gosh. So I asked somebody, have you seen him? He said, well, look over in the commons. Went over, and now the exam's already started, and I'm going running around hunting for my professor. Not in the commons. I did a little more looking around. He wasn't anywhere to be found. I'm looking, thinking, what am I going to do? Well, I kind of realized, look, one thing I've noticed this semester is there's a lot of similarity between American Foreign Policy and International Relations. To heck with it. Let's go take it. I can at least try. And lo and behold, it turned out I think I did as well as I would have if I'd studied for the correct exam, because there was so much overlap with the two courses. And I think that's what horrified Dr. Colvin, that I even thought I could have done as well. It made the studying for the second exam a lot easier. And I think almost everybody's got a story or two like that on exams that they think back and wonder, how could I have been so crazy as to do that? But Dr. Colvin's courses were fascinating and always helpful. Another professor who I might mention that's still there, Dr. Delos Hughes, was my advisor for my politics major, and an excellent gentleman, although he would be the first to tell you I was not much of a student in his course. I remember this probably happens to every student also. I had Dr. Hughes for law and constitutionalism, and it was one of the tougher courses I ever took. And I also took it on a semester when I was taking elementary statistics, which for most students was a bit of a crick course. For me, it was disastrous. Not being a computer jock, I just didn't know what to do. I probably spent 50% of my total exam studying time trying to figure out how I was going to pass some elementary statistics, and that semester law and constitutionalism suffered rather severely. I remember going into my law and constitutionalism exam, sitting down, and for the first hour to an hour and a half, just being completely blank. Five exam questions. I don't know where to start. I don't know how I'm going to pass any of these. And finally got going and did in fact pass the course, although with an embarrassing gentleman C. Again, Dr. Hughes was just a delight to work with, and somebody who I still remember fondly and enjoyed visiting with him a couple of years ago when I was back from my reunion. I had Dr. Phillips for government and business. Again, one of the most interesting courses I can remember. And I believe Dr. Phillips is still there, isn't he? Or did he recently retire?
I think he's retired. And D. Hughes retired.
Oh, he did retire this year?
Yes. Oh, yeah, he's in partial retirement now, right. I think. And he's in phased retirement.
Right.
Everybody was very surprised because he's so young.
Well, Dr. Girard was telling me he's getting a little bit nervous about it because every time they have the graduation ceremonies, it seems he gets closer to the middle. And he told me, I'm not so sure I like that aspect of it. But certainly have very fond memories from the professors I had there, and I'm very grateful that there are that many still there at the university. One thing that you've probably heard more of than you want to hear, but bears repeating. And again, I wish it was something I had thought to do much earlier. Dr. Rupert Latour, I'm sure you've heard more stories about Dr. Latour than you could imagine. But I remember the day of, what did they call it? Not matriculation, but the day all the freshmen checked in.
Freshman camp?
Right, freshman camp. I was after they had the Natural Bridge freshman camp. They had phased that out a couple of years before mm-hmm. I got there, but they had
orientation,
matriculation, mm-hmm. whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And I'd already been there for a week and a half for football. So I was pretty well settled in as far as the dorm rooms go. I remember coming out into the freshman quad, which was very much an institution at that time. There was this old gentleman with about four or five people around him talking to people, and I thought, well, this is strange. I got to go find out what's going on here. He obviously doesn't look like he fits here. And it was Dr. Latour basically visiting with the freshmen, any who were interested, on the history of Washington Lee. And it was so fascinating, I think I ended up standing there listening to him, and people would come and people would go in excess of an hour. May have been an hour and a half, I don't know, a long time. And ended up leaving eventually because I kind of felt this, I had to go matriculate and I needed to do this. But it was one of the most amazing experiences I've ever had because I just was, my mind was boggled. This man is retired. He doesn't have to do this. And he thinks enough of this university and these students, enough of this university to want these students to understand some of this. And I wish I could remember all he told me. I know I remember he told me many things about the university that I never heard anywhere else. Yeah. So I owe him a debt of gratitude. And I remember about 3 years ago, I was listening to a sermon and the preacher said, the fellow teaching the Sunday school class said, look, have you ever tried for a week stopping and telling somebody thanks for something they've done that you always appreciated and you just never got around to saying it? And that got me to thinking. I remembered Dr. Latour and sent back through the university a thank you note to him, just a quick letter saying, I know most of us didn't know we were young in a hurry and didn't stop to say thanks, but I hope you'll realize how I know that meant a whole lot to me. It means more to me now even than it did at the time, perhaps, although it meant quite a bit then. And I hope I can speak for, I'm confident I can speak for a lot of other guys who really genuinely appreciate it. I got a letter back from his son who, you always regret doing something when it's too late, but his son wrote me a letter back and said, hey, we appreciate it. I'm sorry my father's now in a home and not really able to understand what you're saying. Yeah. And that's a lesson in life of not waiting too long to tell somebody something. That's something, quite honestly, I'd almost forgotten about for years, but always appreciated. And if it is of any benefit, I've told that story to several other young men who've been considering going to Washington and Lee subsequently, some of which who have gone. So, believe it or not, Rupert Latour is still remembered, even though he made, I suspect by now he's dead and gone.
Yeah, he died last December, a year ago December.
But as far as stories, I was in Pi Kappa Alpha fraternity, and I guess...
How did you pick Pi K?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I remember it was down between two fraternities. One was the Delta Tau Delta fraternity, which at that time was very much known as the Jock fraternity, particularly lacrosse, but had several football players who I knew as well. And Pi Kappa Alpha was, at that time, they had a reputation for being a party fraternity, but they were also a very diverse fraternity. They had people from everywhere. They had different types of guys. What most people didn't realize is we had a lot of straight guys, too, guys who did very well in school, et cetera. Do you need to leave?
No. Where is the picture?
Let me check something. We back on?
Yep. All
okay.
Right.
Pi Kappa Alpha had an event that I guess in some parts of the university and city became a little bit notorious. It had started the year before I got there. It was known as the Pi Kappa Alpha Annual Festival of Mud, also known as the Mudslide. Have you heard about this one yet?
Keep going.
Okay. The year I got there, I think it was the second annual Festival of Mud. And the mudslide really consisted of two parts. If you look at the front yard of the Pi Kappa Alpha house, you'll notice that there is a slope right near the sidewalk going in through the front of the house. The, if you're facing it, the left side is higher elevation-wise, and then you have a drop of about 4 feet, I would guess, to the right-hand side of the yard. And the Festival of Mud was twofold. Number one, in the yard in between the Phi Del house and the Pi Kappa Alpha house, we had a big mud pit, also known as the gravel pit. And in front of the house, we had what was called a mudslide contest. People would run from the high side coming across from in front of the house, and when they hit the slope, they'd take off sliding, and the idea was to see who could slide the most, who could do this, who could do that. I remember we had we actually had people with scorecards grading the slides for form. It was a pretty wild party with grain punch, etc. It was very, very typical. While I was there, I think my it was either my senior year or my junior year. They just started back up having grain parties in the area in between the Beta House, Phi Delta House, and Pi Kappa Alpha House in Red Square. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what had happened to those grain parties and why they had disappeared before I got when I first got there. But they were, needless to say, very popular, and I noticed they still do that.
Now, when you arrived, was the period when fraternities were sort of at their low point in...
That's correct.
...in membership?
That's correct. I think either the year before I got there, my freshman year, was the first year that less than 50% of the freshman class joined fraternities.
And was that an issue for you? Did you know you wanted to be in a fraternity? Or?
Not a big issue. Really, I was from Dallas, there were five or six guys from my home high school, and I think we had 12 or 13 total from Dallas in that year. No, I didn't feel a burning need to be in a fraternity, but I must admit I found I liked a lot of the guys who were in the fraternities, and I could see a real purpose to it. For all the talk about freedom and not having to be in a fraternity, I knew I didn't have to, but I could see some pretty concrete advantages.
Like what?
Well, one of them is the fraternity would have a pretty good place to stay. Number two, you'd have some social curriculum out there that you could pretty well account on, and that wasn't such a bad deal either. Mm-hmm. Other than that, the only real reason being a fraternity was friendship. And I think that term, and excitement, see how it all worked out. And I know it's rather interesting, most of the people who became my best friends out of my pledge class in my fraternities were not the reasons why I pledged it, and I wouldn't have expected them to be my best friends going in. And I think that's how life works a lot of times. Being in a fraternity was an enjoyable adventure as well. But the fraternity system you did have was still pretty healthy and active, needless to say. I think we probably may have been, I can't say this with any base of knowledge of other time periods, but we're as rowdy as it gets, I imagine.
Tell me what you mean by that.
A lot of it was the sort of silliness that you wish didn't happen. You have some guy breaking a chair, etc. I remember down in our basement where we had our TV, by the time you got to spring, it was your couches, the legs had pretty much been knocked out of them. They were just sitting on the floor, and hopefully the springs weren't busted out of the couch. And it was pretty tough to find chairs. You'd sit on anything you could find, because the chair, you know, furniture had a hard time surviving indefinitely the combo parties. I know at the Pica House, we used to have, my sophomore year or thereabouts, we would have a couple of inches movement in the floor sometimes when we really got a combo party going in our kitchen area. And finally called in a fellow to look at it structurally, and because we were afraid maybe our floor was breaking, and we ended up moving our parties down to the basement, figuring that would be safer. And still felt we were having some problems, so we did various things and finally called in somebody who told us structurally, man, you're just putting a heavy load in it. Don't worry, it's not going to collapse. So we made various changes as we went trying to hang in there. But there was a lot of silly stuff where you'd have people bust out windows. We tried to combat that by requiring the guy who busted it out to go buy a new window and replace it. I remember one time we proposed, and I thought we approved this, but I don't know that it ever got done, going ahead and requiring that any windows were replaced be replaced with plexiglass, so it wouldn't be easy to keep breaking them out. But
smart idea.
Yeah. And I remember one time that I thought this one hurt me to see it happen, but I guess the guys who were taking it out there were the ones who had always played the piano. When I was a freshman, we had a piano in the house. And we had some guys who were pretty good on that piano and can play it pretty well, but due to the beating it had taken during combo parties, etc., because sometimes you get a big combo party and next thing you know, you'd have a couple of guys on top of the piano dancing along with the band or whatever that didn't have dates, etc. The piano had taken a pretty good beating. It was pretty bad shape. I remember my senior year, I think, somebody had the bright idea that there was a bonfire in Red Square. Somebody started a bonfire, and a couple of the guys got the bright idea, and since they were the ones who had always played it, and you know, it kind of felt like it's fair if that's what they want to do, they took the piano out and threw it on the bonfire. Of course, at that stage, it was just a piece of furniture, just a ornament, quite frankly, because it had been beaten up so much, it really wasn't very playable. But there was a lot of silliness like that that I don't think the university needs to miss.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what we talked about earlier. When I went back for my 20th reunion, the students had not changed that much. In fact, I remember when I went back from my 10th reunion, I was amazed at how little things had changed in some respects as far as the students and the type of people who were there, and the fact that they still partied. Heck, I'd been told they don't party at the Pica House anymore. Well, I went back and looked around and said, hey, looks just the same to me. These guys haven't slowed down any. But I think the regimentation by the university, a lot of the university's positions are good and sound. You don't want destruction of the house, but some of it's a little bit too regimented, and that is a concern to me, but I'm not close enough to it to make a firm judgment there.
Did you have a house, Mother, when you were there?
We did. When I got there for my freshman year, we were on our fifth house, Mother, in 4 years, and she had actually lasted a year and a half when I got there. So her name was Franny. And I remember the way she handled combo parties was she had a sister in Clifton Forge. And on Friday afternoon, early Friday afternoon, she'd leave to visit her sister in Clifton Forge, and she'd get back Sunday night. And so she didn't have a problem there. At the time I was in the fraternity, we had a house, Mother, but all the work and all the planning and all the decisions were made. The house, Mother was just an ornament because we were supposed to have a house, Mother. All of the work, right down to the meals, were run by the students. We had our cook, but the menu and directions for the shopping was the responsibility of the vice president. So while we were finally found the house mother we could get along with, I remember, I guess it was the end of my freshman year, they took out the absolute requirement, you must have a house mother. And we looked at it and said, gosh, you know, we like Franny, but this is ridiculous. There's 5% of our budget, or it may have even been 10% of our budget. We're doing all the work anyway. There's no point in having a house mother. And I mean, to the extent there was a belief a house mother was a restraining influence, sorry, it didn't work. So that's why we took one out of the curriculum. And I understand they put them back in. I don't know whether it makes sense or not. I do hope that the house mothers provide a real contribution if they're going to have one to begin with. Because I don't think, from what I've seen, the students haven't changed much. I remember once having a professor tell me that the faculty didn't want to go co-ed because they felt it would be a moderating influence on the student body. And I got a chuckle out of that. I said, don't count on it. And my understanding has been maybe it has slightly, but not much.
How did you come down on co-education?
I was not in favor of it. Interestingly, that was partly based on prior experience. I told you I got into some interesting discussions with John Gunn, and one of those, somehow we got into the subject of the economic impact of co-education on the university. This was while I was a student. You may recall that there was a move to go co-ed back in 1975, which would have been my senior year, or maybe it was 74. I think it was 75, though. 74, 75 range. And I remember visiting with Johnny Gunn, and there had been, I didn't know this, it turned out there had been a move to go co-ed 5 or 6 years before, and Dr. Gunn had been on the committee that had examined the impact of going co-ed. And he pointed out to me the problem was there was a serious economic impact on the university because they had looked at going co-ed, and it wasn't just facilities, the curriculum choices didn't match up. So you would have to make significant changes in your curriculum, broaden it in areas where Washington Lee was narrow, probably narrow it down in areas where Washington Lee was broad and stronger, and the fit wasn't there. Now, I relayed that concern to people at Washington Lee during the co-ed debate, and what I was told is that wouldn't be the case, and it appears to me that has turned out to be the case as best I know. I think there was real concern on my part, and I think others, that this is not a necessary move and it's being taken for the wrong reasons. I don't know if it was taken for the wrong reasons, but it has turned out well, admittedly. The festival of the mudslide happened, I guess this was my junior, senior year. We had a schedule for a Saturday, which was the same Saturday that the lacrosse team had a game. Now, remember, while I was there was the golden age of lacrosse for Washington
Lee. I wanted you to talk about that.
T-Bear, Lichtfuss, Chadwick in goal, and some of those players that are truly legendary even by major college standards. So we happened to have a mudslide scheduled, and being at that time being fairly fervent lacrosse fans, we didn't want to miss the game. So we had the mudslide, and then must have been 25, 30 of us marched up to the stadium and watched the game. Now, you need to understand the mudslide. One of the most amazing things about it is when the mudslide got into full gear, you could not tell who anybody was because everybody was totally covered with mud. You could walk up to somebody you knew, and if they weren't standing up, you'd have to stop and look for a while and see the profile if they weren't saying anything to tell who they were, and even then you might not be sure. So I'm sure that was quite a shock for a lot of people in the stands to see what must have looked like people coming out of the dead marching up into the stands and sitting down. I think we were kind enough to leave a fair distance from everybody else, but I imagine that the section of stands we sat in stayed. Nobody else chose to sit there until they had at least a couple of good hard rains afterwards.
So you really were there in that golden time for lacrosse.
Oh, yes.
I take it you didn't play lacrosse.
No, I did not. Although there were some Texans who did. I remember Steve Norris, for one, took up.
Norris?
Was it Steve Norris?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think so. Steve Norris, he was from Dallas, 2 years behind me. I doubt he'd ever seen a lacrosse game unless he saw one while he visited up there before he came up. But he took up lacrosse and ended up playing on the lacrosse team. He was always a reserve, as I recall. But a lot of Texans really took to lacrosse. It is a very fun game to watch, but Texans are used to football, so it's got a lot of the same natural elements to it. So that was always very interesting and exciting. As far as just true agility, majesty, you know, the sort of beautiful sporting events that are amazing to you, it would be hard to exceed some of the great games, great Washington League games that happened while I was there. So that was fairly exciting. Let's see here. I do remember one thing from Washington League, one tragic story coming out of a lacrosse game, the Roger Lloyd accident coming back. I don't know if you, my senior year, we had been very fortunate. There'd been some accidents, but hadn't lost anybody that I can think of out of our freshman class all the way up through our senior year. And then I remember the spring of our senior year, a couple of Phi Caps were back just running at the track for exercise. One of them had some sort of congenital heart condition that he knew about, but I don't think he had told many other people about. And he was running with one of his fraternity brothers and had heart failure and died right there on the track. And Bulldog Jones, I think, happened to be nearby, and they got Bulldog over immediately. And it wasn't a matter of lack of attention. He just flat, there was nothing anybody could do, I believe. If I remember right, I may be getting it mixed up with Dr. Penny when he died out on the tennis court, which was after I left. Remember my senior year, we had an away lacrosse game. I think it was when we beat Johns Hopkins in Maryland. We beat them, and I remember a bunch of us who did not go to the game were coming, meeting the team when they brought them back to the stadium locker room after the game. And you know, that was pretty unheard of behavior for people from Washington League. We must have had 300 or 400 people up there. And I remember the word came back that after the game, Roger Lloyd and two other Phi Delts had been in an automobile accident, and two were killed immediately, and the other one died a couple of days, had serious, Roger Fulmer, I think it was, had serious internal injuries and died a couple of days later. And I remember, it turns out, one of my fraternity brothers, who was a good friend of Roger's, Roger Lloyd had asked him, had said, "Hey, I'll give you a ride home." And he didn't feel this was a fraternity brother who was pretty wild himself, and he didn't feel comfortable going back with Roger, so he got a ride with somebody else. And turned out that best they could piece together, Roger fell asleep at the wheel. And apparently the other guys weren't awake, and one of them came awake right as they were about to go off the highway, jerked the wheel, but jerked it back the opposite side, sent him out into an open field at, must have been 80, 90 miles an hour from Guy Kerr here in Dallas, I think, was driving behind him and came up behind and saw it. They hit the only thing they could out in that field, which was a highway sign, and unfortunately it was the old style signs that were hard metal. And one of our fraternity brothers was in Winchester, Virginia and got the Winchester paper, and they had a photograph of the fellow trying to cut the top off of it to get the bodies out. And he said, this guy is standing on the back hood of the car, leaning over, working his blowtorch, and he said his head was almost touching the pole as he was working. It was that accordioned. So, very tragic accident. Let's see. What else you got in mind?
Did you get involved with mock convention?
Yes, I did. The mock convention while I was there was my freshman year, so I was not as involved as I might have been. But, yeah, it was enjoyable. That was a fairly wild one, because you may remember that was the one when we had a major argument on the floor as to whether or not Ted Kennedy would accept a draft. And we came very close to forecasting that one right, because, let's see, what was it? In the second ballot, George McGovern came within, probably a dozen votes of getting over the top. But he did not make it over the top, and I think, what was it, in the sixth or seventh ballot, we nominated Hubert Humphrey. No,
you went with Kennedy.
Oh, it was Kennedy? Okay, well, I remember there was a, that's right, the Texas delegation was busy working with other delegations trying to draft Humphrey as an alternative Kennedy. And I remember there, when the Massachusetts delegation chairman came up to throw Kennedy's hat in the ring, there was a major argument with, I think it was the New York delegation, who had addressed the thing with Kennedy's handlers too, and had been told no way he'll accept a draft. So I remember they actually had to go back into the room and argue for about 15 minutes over whether to allow Kennedy's name to be placed in nomination. So it was a pretty wild and woolly convention.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to flip the tape over.